Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for the week ending February 15th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick, here in Boston, Massachusetts, the site of this year's annual AAAS meeting. In this week's Science, the discovery of a solar system a bit like our own, low levels of oxygen in the Pacific, and extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis. We'll also hear from the gonzo scientist about the first-ever Dance Your PhD contest. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
For the first time, researchers have discovered another solar system very much like our own. Scott Gowdy and colleagues report on a paper in this week's Science they found the system using the technique of gravitational microlensing, where starlight is deflected by the gravitational pull of the planets. I spoke with Gowdy about his team's discovery from his office at Ohio State University.
Basically, what we found is a planetary system that looks a lot like our own solar system, two planets orbiting a star about 5,000 light years away. The two planets resemble smaller versions of Jupiter and Saturn. The star itself is smaller, cooler, and a little bit dimmer than the Sun, but the planets are also smaller than Jupiter and Saturn and closer to their parent stars, so the entire system looks like a scale model version of our solar system.
Have multiple planet systems been detected before?
Yes, actually quite a number of them. Of order 30, multiple planets have been found before, almost all with the radial velocity method, one planetary system with the pulsar timing method. But those planetary systems actually don't look very much like our own solar system at all. Those methods that had found planetary systems before tend to be sensitive to planets that are much closer to their parent stars. So they found giant planets very close to their parent stars, some with orbits even closer than Mercury is to our Sun. And so these look very unlike our own solar system, where we have giant planets that are all located in the outer regions of our solar system.
So what did your team do differently?
So we used a different method, which has different selection biases. The method we use is called gravitational microlensing. Basically, what we do is we use the gravity of the star and the planet system. It magnifies the light from a background star. And so by monitoring the complex changes of the magnified light of the background star as the planetary system passes in front, we can learn something about the star and its planets. And this method is sensitive to planets that are further out, separations much further from their parent star than the radial velocity method, and in particular, almost ideally sensitive to planets like Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune, planets that are further out from their parent stars.
Aren't there other reasons why stars have variable brightness?
Yeah, there's a lot of other reasons, and one of the initial challenges of using microlensing to do anything, but in particular to look for planets, is to try to figure out ways to exclude other reasons for the stars to get brighter or fainter. We've gotten pretty good at it, and so now we're pretty confident when we see something get brighter and then fainter in a characteristic way, we know that it's due to microlensing and not sort of some sort of intrinsic variability of the star.
What about the future for this technique?
We're getting a lot better at this technique. It's still a relatively new technique. It hasn't found very many planets. This is the fifth and sixth planets ever to be found by this method. But just in the last year, we've actually doubled the number of planets found by microlensing. We're finding strange systems around very low-mass stars, very low-mass planets. And so we can expect in the next few years that we'll learn a lot of new things from this technique.
What does this mean for planet formation theory?
So before the discovery of planets outside the solar system, theorists had thought that most solar systems were supposed to look like our own solar system, not surprisingly. But then when radial velocity techniques started to uncover planetary systems, they found they looked absolutely nothing like our own solar system. They had huge, enormous, giant planets the size of Jupiter or larger, with periods of tens of days or 20 days, even closer to their parent stars than Mercury. And so that was a pretty strong indication that their theories of planet formation were probably incomplete. But it was still an unknown what the frequency of solar system analogs, solar systems that, like our own, that formed in a similar manner to our own, it was unknown how frequent those were. And so our discovery seems to indicate that at least some of them do form in this way that was originally envisioned before the discovery of all these additional planets. And so it sort of confirms that the earlier theories were not incorrect, just incomplete.
Scott Gowdy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Gowdy is lead author of a paper on the discovery of a Jupiter-Saturn analog system that's about 5,000 light-years away. Read the paper in this week's Science. Ocean oxygen levels just off the western coast of the U.S. have been much lower than normal, and even dropped once to zero in 2006. In a paper in this week's Science, Francis Chan and colleagues reported their findings and also sent along a video they have taken of the affected area. The video shows mass extinction of the marine life that either could not move out of the area or could not move fast enough, like crabs. From his office at Oregon State University, Chan spoke with me about why these low oxygen zones happen and their impact on the ecosystem.
We've been observing these low oxygen zones along the coast of Oregon, but also as well as Washington. And these low oxygen zones are something that we've known to exist in deeper, further offshore waters for a long time. But what's new is that they're developing very, very close to shore, and they're actually reaching levels that are just outside what we think of the norm. They're very low, and as a matter of fact, in 2006, they got so low that we started to hit zero, and that's a new development for the ecosystem along our coast.
Could you describe what the seafloor looks like after one of these low oxygen events?
All the fishes are gone. They either suffocate or they move away from the low oxygen waters and try to find some kind of refuge, some perhaps places closer to the surf where there's more oxygen because of mixing. Now, there's a whole host of other marine life that really can't move away fast enough, and these benthic marine life, they just have to try to ride it out. But what we've seen is that when oxygen levels get so low for so long is that they succumb eventually. And on some of these surveys that we've done, we see only carcasses of marine life, everything from crabs to marine worms to sea cucumbers to these large sea stars that are rotting on the seafloor. And the next set of mystery to solve is, like, what does it mean for the ecosystem? And I think the important ecological question is, how do these events reverberate years from now? Because, you know, the data isn't in as far as how this can impact either the young of the year or how it may affect organisms that are just migrating through the area.
How do these low oxygen events happen?
Well, it's a two-edged sword in operating this system. On the one hand, the reason why we have such an amazingly productive coastal ecosystem is because we have these upwelling winds. So these winds that blow from the north to the south, and they're the engine that drive ocean currents along our coast. And the key part is that they're bringing water, that these currents bring water that is deeper in the ocean, that is very rich in nutrients. And when you bring these parcels of water up into the sunlight, the phytoplankton, these plants that are the base of the food web, they really respond. They bloom, they go to town, and because they're the base of the food web, they're what's supporting all of the marine life above it, everything from sardines up to whales. But the flip side of that is that that water that comes up is also very low in oxygen because they come from very deep in the ocean. And so we have these low oxygen waters move in to our very shallow systems when the winds are blowing the right way for a sufficiently long time. And so we're moving very low oxygen water. And the other part is that we also have this very productive water column, so lots of green cells in the surface water. Well, you know, they're going to sink eventually, and when they sink, they decompose, and that's a 1-2 punch where we actually get lower oxygen in the bottom of the water column over time. Now, a lot of people, are more familiar with low or zero oxygen systems that form in bays or estuaries that are receiving a lot of runoff from the watershed, and that's a very classic and typical low oxygen zone. And in those systems, there's a very restricted circulation, so that productive water that are in these bays, they just kind of cook there, and then all of the cells sink and decompose and rob the bottom water of the oxygen. But the system that we're describing is actually right along the open Pacific Ocean, and we're seeing low oxygen form right on the edge of this open part of the Pacific Ocean.
Where else do these low oxygen events happen in the open ocean?
You can find this upwelling driven low oxygen zones. You can find them along the coast of Chile and Peru, as well as the coast of South Africa and Namibia. And so we share a couple commonalities with those other large marine ecosystems in that the U.S. West Coast, like Peru, Chile, and Namibia and Southern Africa, are all upwelling ecosystems. So in each of those examples, winds play a major role in driving how productive the water is, but also in driving how much low oxygen water can actually form along the coast.
Well, does this observed low oxygen event off the coast of Oregon suggest some change in ocean currents in the area, or is this possibly just a regular current that hasn't been observed before?
Yeah, you know, it's been very important for us to try to resolve whether this is something that has always happened and we're seeing just because we're a little better at going out to sea, or we have more accurate or more precise instruments out there observing the ocean. But when we look at this vast body of historical data set of historical oxygen measurements, we just don't see the kind, the severity of low oxygen events in any of that historical record. So the answer is that this is something that is new. And then as far as why this is happening now and not previously, well, over the past 5-6 years, we've observed sort of year-to-year changes in how severe or how bad or how shallow this low oxygen zone is. In some years, it almost doesn't form. In other years, it can be very dramatic. And what we've been able to tell is that these year-to-year changes in how severe the low oxygen zone is directly tied to these year-to-year changes in ocean currents and coastal winds. So now we know that if the winds or the currents change, that's one thing that is really going to have important consequences for something as basic as the amount of oxygen that you have in the ocean.
Francis Chan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Francis Chan is lead author of a paper on the low oxygen zones in the California Current Large Marine Ecosystem. Read the paper in this week's Science. While millions of people carry the bacterium for tuberculosis, a much smaller number of people get it, and researchers aren't exactly sure why. For those who do, the typical treatment is a drug regimen that lasts 6 to 8 months. But tuberculosis is becoming extensively drug-resistant, and for those strains of TB, treatments can take 2 years or more. In this week's Science, correspondent Robert Koenig reports on the spread of extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis in South Africa, where the spread of HIV/AIDS, along with TB, is proving to be a deadly combination.
If you talk to people at the World Health Organization, they're feeling they're getting a handle on the spread of tuberculosis worldwide. It's finally starting to level off. However, they're quite worried about drug-resistant tuberculosis. That is, strains of TB that are resistant to the normal regimen of 4 drugs that are used to treat the disease. So there's quite a bit of concern about whether these new strains are likely to spread to certain regions of the world.
How do diseases like tuberculosis become drug-resistant?
The theory is that they become drug-resistant partly because people who are treated with the first-line drugs for normal TB default on their therapy. Typically, under TB treatment, you take drugs for 6 to 8 months, and you have to be very regular about it and take these drugs exactly when the doctor prescribes. And if you default on that is, take the drugs for 2 months or so and then stop, then you're giving the tuberculosis bacterium in your body a chance to develop resistance. And so the next time you try those same drugs, some of those bacteria will have a resistance and will not be killed. And what this article is about is extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, which is the most feared strains because they're very hard to treat. Because they're resistant to almost all the normal first or second-line drugs that are used in tuberculosis therapy.
What are the treatment options available for those with this extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis?
At the moment, there are limited options. As I understand it, at least here in Africa, the doctors are tending to use second-line medications that haven't been widely used in recent years. In other words, were developed in the 1950s or so and perhaps used back then, but then were superseded by other more effective drugs. And the reason that these old drugs were superseded is often related to the fact that they're more toxic to the system than are the more recently developed drugs. Are there other reasons they're considered less effective? So because those haven't been used in recent years in typical therapy, the doctors tend to go back to those and use them now because in the hope that the bacterium will quickly develop resistance to those. In the meantime, several drug groups, nonprofit organizations that are dedicated to trying to find a solution to drug-resistant tuberculosis are in the process of testing some other potential new drugs. So it may take years before these new medications are available for widespread use.
Now, if a regular course of treatment for tuberculosis, for normal tuberculosis, takes 6 to 8 months, what's it take if you've got one of these drug-resistant strains?
The recommendation these days is a drug regimen, which is quite severe because some of the drugs have toxic side effects that can last up to 2 years. And so we're talking about huge amounts of time and lots of money in some cases to treat these. There's been studies of the cost of treating multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, and the estimates range from 3 times to 100 times the cost of treating normal TB. That's because the drugs used in the typical regimen to treat normal TB are fairly inexpensive and common, and those used to treat highly drug-resistant TB are less common, much more expensive, and then must be administered over a much longer period. It's also advisable in the search of at least extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis to try to separate the patients from other people, especially those who are HIV positive and have compromised immune systems.
Is there any concern that this will overwhelm the healthcare system?
I don't think extensively drug-resistant TB has quite gotten to that point. Although the number of people diagnosed last year, 500, is probably a fraction of the total number, because many go undiagnosed. And the reason is that the diagnostics, the tools used to find out whether TB strains are drug resistant, are at the moment a bit time-consuming and expensive. It takes up to a month or two to determine whether the TB that you have is drug resistant. And that's an expensive process, and only certain medical centers have the capability to do that. And that's something that's being improved in South Africa and in other countries with the help of the World Health Organization and other international institutions. But it's taking a while.
Are there better diagnostics available?
The story talks a bit about efforts to develop new and faster molecular-based diagnostics that could, in a period of hours, determine whether certain types of drug resistance are present in a bacterial strain. And there's hope that such tools will be available widely, at least in South Africa, sometime later this year.
Robert Koenig, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science correspondent Robert Koenig on extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis. Read the article in this week's Science. Can scientists dance? Gonzo scientist John Bohannon decided to hold a contest to find out. The rules of the contest were simple. Using no words or images, interpret your PhD as a dance. The winner swept the competition away with an interpretation of refitting repasts, a spatial exploration of food processing, sharing, cooking, and disposal at the Dunefield Midden campsite, South Africa. John Bohannon joined me to talk about it.
So this all started with a conversation at a party in Vienna. I was talking to this molecular biologist that I've come to know there named Chris Komprager. He usually is in the laboratory as a PhD student at the Medical University of Vienna. He studies colorectal cancer, which is about as far from DJ music as you can imagine, but he's actually a very talented DJ. So we were talking about his next gig, and he mentioned that he's using sounds in his laboratory for an experimental DJ set. He makes recordings of DNA sequencers and all these things that make noise in a laboratory and turning it into music. And the more we talked about it, the more I got wondering, what would the audience be like at this gig? It's bound to be packed with scientists because all his friends are scientists. And I started wondering whether it would be kind of like those dances at scientific conferences that are kind of like weddings. They're incredibly awkward. Or is it going to be like other nights out that I've seen with scientists where they're the most interesting people on the dance floor? There's something special about the scientists dancing. Sometimes they really shine. So I wanted to know which is reality. Or are they both true? Basically, I wanted to ask the question, can scientists dance?
And how did it turn into a contest?
I wanted to get a lot of data. And so I wanted to encourage the scientists to actually dance. And as a warm-up event for his DJ gig, I'd hold this contest.
And what was the prize?
In the beginning, I was thinking of giving away laser pointers with an inscription on it saying something like Best Dancer 2008. But in the end, science agreed to chip in a year's subscription to the magazine.
So who was in this contest?
Well, we had 12 dances. Some were solo and some were kind of team efforts. So all told, about 24 dancers.
And what were the rules for this contest?
So the rules were really simple. First, I read out the title of a person's PhD thesis. I gave each PhD thesis dancer 30 seconds to 60 seconds to summarize their research. I figured that the judges have only so much knowledge about all these fields of science because we had an anthropologist, an astronomer, a science communicator, and a dancer. It was a panel of four judges. And then the lights went down. And then when the lights came up, that person, with or without help from their fellow grad students and postdocs, had to interpret that PhD thesis in dance form with no words, no PowerPoint, no images, just dance.
So then the lights went down, the lights came up, and what did you see?
That was the surprising part, as you can imagine. The dances were incredibly diverse. We had everything from tango and tap to improv breakdancing. They also covered every field of science, from astrophysics to anthropology and archaeology to molecular biology.
Did the crowd ever get a little rowdy?
Oh, there were moments of rowdiness. I got a little worried for the safety of the dancers, actually. At one point during Superti Furga's dance, there was a kind of strip scene. They had their back to the audience and they were slowly taking off their clothes. And the crowd was enthusiastic, let's just say.
Now, in Drew Gonzo style, did you participate?
It was only fair that I should also do a dance. My PhD was on a set of genes in Pseudomonas fluorescens, which is a soil bacterium, and I was looking at how they evolve over periods of days and weeks. And so for my dance, I got a bunch of other people, cannibalized other dancers in the contest, and I created an algorithmic dance. My instructions were just get on stage and imitate this group of genes. One talks to the other in a sequence. And so I asked them to invent interactions and basically mutate. And that was it.
And in the end, who won?
The winners were determined by a panel of four judges, and each of those judges made an independent assessment on a 20-point scale. I gave them 3 5-point scales for creativity, scientific, physical, and artistic, and then one bonus scale with an attribute of their choosing, whether it be philosophical depth or costumes or whatever. And so all the scores were pooled for a total possible of 80 points. Most of the dances hovered around the 20s and 30s for a total score, but Brian Stewart got 54 out of 80. So he not only won his category, the student category, but he was the winner overall.
Tell me about his dance.
All right, first of all, he showed up wearing nothing but a loincloth. That's pretty awesome. But second of all, he managed in less than 1 minute to summarize the essence of his PhD. His work is essentially an archaeological study of Paleolithic garbage in South Africa. And he tries to figure out how people processed their food, shared it, and disposed of it. And so he boiled all of that research down to this very stylized, very funky dance in which he hunted another archaeologist as she played an antelope and killed her, processed her dead body, and then that dead antelope transformed into another person, part of his group, who was shivering by a fire, and he shared the skin with her. And then there's this magical moment where he just kind of boogies off stage. He carefully chose that moment in the music that he was playing, which was Watermelon Man by Herbie Hancock, which is a classic kind of funky experimental jazz piece that uses African pygmy calls as its basis. So the whole thing just came together in this sort of physical poem of science.
John Bohannon, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science correspondent and Gonzo scientist John Bohannon on the first ever Dance Your PhD contest. See videos of the dancers on our website at www.gonzoscientist.org. Finally today, and direct from the AAAS annual meeting in Boston, Massachusetts, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, I'm going to share with you three stories. We're going to talk about what causes muscle fatigue. Researchers have finally figured that out, or at least they think they have. And a Valentine's Day story for you, Rob. We're going to talk about how an alligator's heart helps its stomach. And finally, we'll talk about how increased blood flow to a certain part of the brain helps monkeys identify other monkeys.
Well, let's start then with muscle fatigue. I always thought it was lactic acid that built up, and that's why you got sore after you exercised.
That's what I thought too, but apparently that's a discounted theory. Physiologists actually thought for about 80 years that the reason our muscles fatigued was because of lactic acid, which they thought somehow built up in the muscles and somehow interfered with the muscles' contractile proteins, which would, they thought, cause fatigue. But this idea has been disproven because they found at realistic body temperatures, not that much lactic acid actually builds up in muscles. And also a recent study showed that lactic acid can actually improve muscle performance.
So what actually is causing muscle fatigue?
Well, a team of researchers wanted to find out. And what they knew already was that in some kinds of heart failure, a protein called calstabin doesn't bind as well to calcium channels in the heart as it should. And this causes the calcium channels to be leaky or stay open when they shouldn't be open. And what this does is drain calcium stores in the heart muscle and causes the heart muscle to get tired very quickly.
So calcium is needed to trigger contraction?
Exactly. And so the team wondered, is the same thing going on in different kinds of muscles, like skeletal muscles? So what they did was they put a group of mice on an intense marathon scale training program. And what this involved was getting a group of the mice to swim for 90 minutes twice a day for 2 weeks.
Or keep from drowning.
Exactly. And the control group of mice only had to swim for 15 minutes twice a day, so they got off a lot easier. And the researchers found that just like what was happening in failing heart muscle, these mice that were really exercising to the limits showed similar defects in their calcium channels. Their calcium channels were staying open longer than they should have been and were being leaky.
Meaning that they needed more time to recover?
Exactly. The mice that were exercising very heavily needed sometimes days to recover from their physical exertion.
Well, how does this apply to people?
Well, the team also looked at humans, and they tested their hypothesis on 12 elite athletes, people that normally run marathons or cycle for long periods of time. And what they found is, just like the mice, after intense periods of activity, these people also had leaky calcium channels in their muscle.
What about for the rest of us, those of us who aren't extreme athletes?
Well, for the time being, this seems to only apply to extreme athletes. So for the average Joe that just exercises on weekends, there may be another mechanism at play in the fatigue that they experience.
Any way to overcome this fatigue?
Well, interestingly, as part of their study, the researchers developed a drug that was able to cause the protein calstabin to actually bind to the calcium channels longer and keep them closed when they needed to be closed. So the drug made the channels less leaky. And at least when they gave this drug to the mice, they found that the mice could run about 10 to 20% longer when they were on the drug than when they weren't on the drug. So it seemed to boost endurance.
Is that something that we're going to have to worry about for athletic events of the future?
I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But for right now, the drug's not even on the market.
Okay, well, from leaky calcium channels in muscles to a story about the most important muscle, the heart. How does an alligator's heart help its stomach?
Well, Rob, this story is about the unusual circulatory system of the alligator. And alligators have four-chambered hearts like we do, and they pump blood just like we do. They breathe in oxygen into their lungs, and the blood that passes by their lungs gets oxygenated and pumped to the rest of the body. But what's interesting about alligators is that they don't have to pump blood this way. In fact, they can switch to a more primitive blood pumping system, whereby they bypass their lungs completely, and instead of reoxygenating their blood that's already traveled to their body tissues, they can send this deoxygenated blood back to their tissues, and specifically their gut.
More primitive. Doesn't sound so primitive. We only have one circulatory system.
More primitive in the sense that this is a system actually used by other reptiles.
Well, why does the alligator and these other reptiles have a system that pumps deoxygenated blood directly from the heart to the gut?
Well, at least for the alligator, there's been two hypotheses. And one is that they're somehow keeping carbon dioxide out of their lungs during long dives, which might be useful. But the other hypothesis is that it somehow aids digestion.
And the higher levels of CO2 help in that way?
Well, that's what a team of researchers wanted to find out. And so what they did was they took some probes and they put it around the aortas of alligators. And this allowed them to monitor the blood flow in the alligator. And what they found was that alligators most often made the switch to this more primitive circulation pattern when they had just eaten a big meal. So that was the first evidence for this digestion hypothesis. But the researchers went even further, actually a lot further, and they actually performed surgery on 9 of the gators, and they closed off their left aorta. And what this did was it prevented the gators from switching to the more primitive circulatory pattern. So in other words, these gators that were operated on could only pump blood like you and I do. And what they found is that these gators that had undergone the surgery had a much harder time digesting a nice big meal of chopped steak than control alligators did. And what's more, the control alligators, the ones that were able to switch, had enormous amounts of gastric acid in their stomach. In fact, 10 times more than has been seen in any other animal. So these alligators that had the ability to switch back and forth somehow were able to really boost gastric acid levels in their stomach, whereas the alligators that got operated on, the ones that couldn't make the switch, didn't.
So with a bigger meal, they were able to digest it faster.
Exactly. And the researchers think the reason is because when the alligators shunt this carbon dioxide-rich blood to their guts, it's actually helping produce gastric acid. So when alligators eat a big meal, and they need to do so quickly, which often happens with alligators, they're able to just flip a switch, as it were, and send deoxygenated blood to their gut.
Well, from higher blood flow to the alligator's stomach to higher blood flow in parts of monkeys' brains. How does that help them hear other monkeys?
It's a good question, Rob. This research concerns the ability of animals to distinguish other animals' voices from, say, natural sounds. And obviously, you and I can tell when another person is speaking versus, say, when a faucet is running, like that. And they know monkeys can do this too. And researchers have been curious, do monkeys use the same brain region to distinguish other monkey voices as we do? Because they're looking for clues to how that region evolved. Well, Rob, when you and I hear, say, each other's voices, there's increased blood flow to a part of the brain called the temporal lobe, and not the entire temporal lobe, just one specific part of it, which, as you might expect, is thought to play a role in helping us recognize other individuals by voice. And researchers wondered, is the same region involved in monkeys? So they put monkeys in an fMRI machine, and this is basically a machine that measures increases in blood flow to various parts of the brain. And they played for them a variety of sounds, including other monkey coos and grunts and other vocalizations, but they also played calls of other animals and natural noises like thunder and running water. And what they found is, just like humans, a region of the temporal lobe lit up. It wasn't the same exact region as in humans, but it was also part of the temporal lobe. So based on this, researchers say that monkeys also appear to have a region of their brain that's dedicated to recognizing other monkey voices.
Well, does this provide any clues to the evolution of speech?
Well, the researchers think it does, and they say now that they've located this region in monkeys, it's possible that the same neural circuits that are responsible for monkeys understanding other monkey voices eventually became neural circuits that we use, not only to understand other people's voices, but that are even involved in more complex tasks such as speech.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So tell us what's going to be happening with the Science Now site during the rest of the AAAS meeting.
When people come to the site, they'll see that we're blogging this year from the meeting. We'll have reporters covering a lot of the sessions, and we'll be posting fun facts and tidbits from the meeting, as well as interviews with interesting speakers and news items. So check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check out the latest science stories, plus regular updates from the annual AAAS meeting in Boston, Massachusetts at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the Science Podcast for the week ending February 15th, 2008. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.